so serious.
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game? Yeah!
Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we're finally ready to do this.
Yes.
I apologize for a ton of production delays that the listeners have no idea about, but we're ready to go. It's the Toy Department.
I got an idea now.
Yeah. I like to break that fourth wall every now and again, Matt Kolsky.
No, it's good. You're bringing the people into the clubhouse, as it were.
Maybe people think we just get on here and this magic just happens, but no. It takes at least 4 minutes of preparation every time.
Minimum. And, let's not understate, you're an important man with an important job and responsibilities, and so oftentimes I chill out in my room drinking coffee and reading internet news while I wait for schedule to allow.
Well,
for
grumble, I got shit to do, grumble, pretty much.
Yeah. No, don't get me wrong. Drinking coffee and reading internet news is what I was going to do with that time anyway, so it really makes no difference one way or the other to me.
Are you not working on your fantastic new column?
Oh, thank you. I am working on a new column for next week. I am writing columns for The Examiner in San Francisco, which is very exciting. I've been in print before, but only as like a high school stringer back in my Oakland Tribune and or Chicago Sun-Times days. So, having like a picture and a byline and getting to write my opinions and have it printed out in a newspaper is pretty exciting. But yeah, it's on the web too. If anyone wants to look me up, sfexaminer.com. My name is still Matt Kolsky, and there's only one article now, but I liked it. And it pertains a little bit to stuff we'll talk about later in the pod.
Excellent. All right. Well, we will get to that in a bit. But first, I know we wanted to, look, we're going to get to Game of Thrones. I have some hot movie takes that we'll get to, but we wanted to catch up on something that we talked about a while ago, The Handmaid's Tale.
Yes. I don't know actually what popped this into my brain this morning other than thinking about things we had not followed up on the podcast, which, of course, could have led me down any number of roads. But I think when we talked about it, if I remember correctly, I was enjoying it, but in a relatively lukewarm way.
Well, it is one of those shows that it's a tough watch, right? So it's not,
well,
it's hard to be enthusiastic all the time about it.
Yes, that's true to some degree for the whole show. But I did think it became less of a tough watch, not because it let up emotionally, but because it picked up in terms of plot and story and action. And so the analogy I came up with when I was thinking about this before we got on the line was, you know the Beatles song She's So Heavy on Abbey Road?
Yeah, I Want You, She's So Heavy.
Exactly.
Yeah, great song.
It's a great, great song. It's on either the start of the back half or the end of the front half. It's right before the long run of songs that are all sort of one big song, the sort of Abbey Road suite. And what the general pace of the song begins with a slow sort of, I feel like, reverb heavy and out there minor guitar thing. And it's really just them hollering and wailing for the most part. She's so heavy. And it slowly picks up and there's more and more noise and the urgency increases. And there's this sort of, until there's this loud wall of sound, and then boom, it just stops. Silence. And that's how this season felt to me, was we open on the slow, sort of oppressed and threatening of violence, but generally very quiet existence of this woman, or so it seems, for an episode. And then the menace increases and the violence increases. And I don't know if it's fair to say the stakes increase, because it's always a high stakes show from the moment it begins, but it's, there's pressure, and you feel, yes, it's a, still a hard watch, but there's that excitement of watching something where you feel it rising to a crescendo. And the finale, spoiler alert, ends in this place where there's still a lot of unknown. There's a lot of drama to come for our characters, quite clearly. But it's built to this level where it's set up two sides, and there is a resistance, and these characters that we've come to root so desperately for are sort of in position where something crazy is about to happen. And that's where it leaves us heading for season two. I think they get a ton of credit for really cleverly crafting this building crescendo. And I know I was left very interested in more.
Oh, yeah, I would definitely like to see more. I think, you know, and I don't know, maybe you won't be receptive to this, but for me, a lot of that just rests on Elizabeth Moss being riveting.
She was incredible. But yeah. I also think Samira Wiley, however you say her name, is excellent. I think Anne Dowd, you know, I'm not sure you would applaud this role for its range as compared to The Leftovers. She seems to do a thing, but she does it exceptionally well. And, you know, yes, Elizabeth Moss is phenomenal, but I think the rest of the show gets a lot of credit too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Believe me. It's not like, it's not just an Elizabeth Moss centerpiece. Like, there's a lot going on. It's a very, I think, visually interesting show.
Yeah. Like, we watched Top of the Lake, obviously, and that was a good show where Elizabeth Moss was great. I feel like Handmaid's Tale, really, by the end of it, I felt like was a pretty great show overall.
I'm all in on Handmaid's Tale, and I would watch some more. I would recommend it to people, but it's always, to me, I feel like one of those shows that you got to recommend with a caveat, because you have to be willing to spend time, a significant amount of time, in this sort of dystopian, oppressed, future world.
In a nasty, nasty place. Yeah, you do.
And I think it's perfectly reasonable in our mildly oppressed, mildly dystopian current world that you might not be in the mood for that.
No question. But I think where after three or four or five episodes, I would have said, you know, if you don't feel like you want to watch it, skip it. I think after finishing it, I would say, if you feel you can handle it, you should watch it.
Now, would you say that, we haven't really talked about this on or off pod, but I've been catching up on Big Little Lies. I'm five episodes in. I'm probably close enough to the end now that I'm going to finish, but like, would you say that to someone who is that far into Big Little Lies?
I don't know if I would recommend it as strongly. I loved it. I so love the women on it that I loved watching it, and that was enough to power me through the end. And I do think it was good. I don't know that it was as good a show as Handmaid's Tale.
It doesn't seem to me to be. And I love the cast in general, not just the women. There are a lot of people in that show that I really enjoy, but there's something about it that leaves me meh.
They lead it, but
yeah, just there's a lot of the show that leaves me meh, and I can't totally put my finger on it.
I feel that, and I was so impressed by Nicole Kidman, though. I think before this year, seeing Lion and Big Little Lies, I kind of forgot about Nicole Kidman a little bit as an actress.
Yeah, no, she's done a good job of pretty much reminding her she's still there and still killing it, you know?
Right. She's still a really good actress. She's not just like a weird ice queen, pretty lady who like makes celebrity appearances. Cause I feel like there were a few years there where that was mostly her role. And,
Oh, shots at Tom Cruise.
Oh yeah. No, look, I'm as excited for this new crazy Tom Cruise movie I keep seeing previews for as anyone, but you can't ignore that that guy takes wives and, like...
Stepford wives them?
Yes.
Is Stepford a verd? He Stepfords them?
Stuff happens to them. It's not good.
I'm barely interested in seeing Tom Cruise's movie, so I'm definitely not interested in diving into his personal life and or demons.
Yeah, true. Let's move on.
Do you want to jump to the world of movies before we hit the Thrones, or should we do the Thrones first?
Let's hit the Thrones. I mean, it's been long enough, for God's sakes. I'm so thrilled by every second of this show that I think I'm becoming a little bit worthless as any level of critic.
Okay. That's interesting you say that, because I do feel like this was kind of, you know, this was the exposition scene of episodes. You know what I mean? Like, it was very, like, as we talked about peace moving kind of in the first episode, but this, I felt like this was, there was a ton of that. I mean, you get a great battle scene at the end. A little bit hokey compared to, say, Hard Home.
Well, sure, but it is what it is. It's the Greyjoys murdering each other. You know, I mean,
kinda.
I think we always knew it would come to this, right?
I mean,
we didn't maybe think it would happen in episode two, but like the Greyjoys murdering each other in some form or fashion was inevitable.
Yeah, I mean, clearly there was going to be some of that. We didn't necessarily know the Sand Snakes were going to perish, but man, I can't say I'm sorry that it happened. Although we don't really know if they're all gone. I mean, we know at least one of them is still alive.
Right.
And maybe more. I'm sure we'll see as it goes.
Yeah. I think the let's not assume anyone's dead unless it's been clearly shown their like rotting body or dismembered head. Because, you know, people can come back from being real dead, never mind survive crazy wounds on this show. That said, yeah, we know none of those characters are likely to factor into the Game of Thrones ultimately, as it were.
Yeah, you know, I'm interested.
Nobody thought one of those teenage girls was going to usurp Danny and take the throne.
No, for sure.
Nobody thought Theon was going to stumble into being on the Iron Throne, you know? Or even Yara, who I will say is one of my favorite characters.
Really?
I love the way the actress plays it as like she's just a bawdy seaman. You know what I mean? Like, the fact that she happens to be a lady is irrelevant.
I honestly, for a second, did not realize you meant semen with an A. It took me a minute. I get what you're
like
saying.
A stereotypical, you know, drunken, horny sea pirate. She just happens to be a lady. And I find her so endearing and wonderful. And the way she has, although this gruff exterior and totally convincing physical presence, she has like, she cares about her brother. She, you know, she has a heart in her own way. And like, even when she can't help making fun of the fact that he's had his manhood severed, she also afterwards is like, my bad. I love you, little brother.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. She's the most interesting Greyjoy, but that is definitely a tallest dwarf situation.
Yeah, and
I mean, well, you know, is it Euron? Who's the?
Euron is the bad uncle.
One. He's you know, I sort of like the retooling of him, but he was always boring in the past. Now that he's like, you know, doing the poor man's Johnny Depp in Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, with like the leather jackets and stuff, I think he's a little more interesting. Yeah. But man, I don't know. anytime you get a Greyjoy scene, I feel like it's mostly a slog relative to other things that you could be doing.
I don't think it's fair to call that battle scene a slog. It may not have been Hard Home or Battle of the Bastards, but it was pretty exciting.
No, I wouldn't call the battle scene itself a slog.
I hear you. No, I hear what you're saying. And I also hear your and many others' complaints about exposition. But there's a lot. I find myself a little bit. It's progressive exposition. In other words, it's explaining where people are headed and why.
Yeah. And look, there's a definite amount of exposition on this show with this many characters and this many things happening is totally necessary. I get it.
That's right. And I don't find those scenes boring. When John is giving his speech and Lyanna Mormont is arguing with grown men, like, I am locked in. I am engaged with that.
Can I bring up two points of realism? I know you're not a maester or anything, but I feel like there are two questions I want to ask about the world of Game of Thrones.
I'm not a true expert, especially since I have not read but the first 2.5 books, but I will do my best.
All right, the first. So, you know, in the scene you're talking about where they're trying to decide whether or not they're going to go, whether Jon Snow is going to go visit Dany, which, I mean, of course he is. Like, Jon Snow and Sansa are sitting here talking and plotting and strategizing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
Why didn't they make that plan in private?
Yeah, like, she's completely unaware of this, of his decision. Where she's like, who, you know, well, who's going to be the king? Like, he wouldn't be like, hey, I'm going to do this. We need to, you know, we have this offer. It's pretty dangerous. I'm going to take it. You're going to be in charge. Like, there's that conversation doesn't take place. Seems a little weird, right?
I mean, yeah, it seems like dramatic effect
to have it
in a room full of people. But, you know, yeah, okay, fine. I'll take it.
Here's the other question I have. Ravens. Right, so you're taking these birds and you're flying them very long distances to deliver mm-hmm. messages.
Yeah,
I have to think that this is not a 100% sort of delivery kind of service, right? Like, there's a lot of things that could happen in a raven from one place to the next.
Also, there are dragons.
There are dragons. Yeah, you know what I mean. Like, do ravens always get there? Are they foolproof?
How do they know? You misunderstand my point.
You're just saying, like, there's magic in this world. Shut up. Are you saying the birds are magic?
Are they magic? I don't know. But they're clearly something different than the raven that you're looking out your studio window at cawing from the tree.
Well, like, okay. So if the ravens always get there and they're magic ravens, then why don't people send ravens all the time? Like, there clearly people have lack of information in this.
Right. And I think clearly ravens have been intercepted and shot down in the past. I think we've seen that storyline on this show, if I recall correctly. When a castle was under siege, it was hard, if not impossible, for them to get ravens out. But, you know.
I just feel like ravens are a convenient plot device at certain times.
I think ravens are a plot device. At the same time, you know, it's not that crazy to ask people to make the jump to ravens delivering messages most of the time, given a world where there are dragons.
Yeah, I suppose. I'm picking nits because you know, you watch an hour Game of Thrones and then talk about it every week and you start thinking about stuff. That's one of the things I think about. Totally. Do ravens always get there? You know, I would rather think about that than the pus that comes out of a grayscale.
That was intense. I was very on edge throughout that scene.
I don't know that it was intense because my head was 180 degrees turned around from the television screen while I determined what was happening. Just zero chance I was watching that.
They did not short us shots of grayscale being sliced off of raw underneath layers of skin. Even thinking about it is making my skin crawl a little bit.
And then
the
transition to the pie was just, that's just mean.
Yep.
Just mean. And second week that they've done that, by the way.
Yes. from nastiness to food.
Yeah. And in week one was and back again too. So cut it out, Game of Thrones.
By the way, fun to see Hot Pie, and exciting potential Stark sister reunion coming up.
Potential, although I'm not, you know, I feel like the Arya's direction may be a red herring a little bit. Like, right? Are we? We're another meant to assume
she
that she's
be
headed
waylaid by another person on her list on the way.
Yeah, home. We're meant to assume she's headed back to Winterfell, right? But I feel like
I think so.
I feel like the heavily
all we
CGI
really know
dire
is
wolf
she's not
encounter
heading to King's Landing, right? Yeah.
You know, right. But, you know, I have a feeling she could wind up somewhere else. It's just what I'm thinking. All in all, like, you know, look, it's a very fun hour of television. I'm looking forward to the next one. They're a bit better episodes. But, you know, hey, John and Danny in a room next week should be fantastic.
John and Danny in a room. Arya either in a room with Sansa or on some crazy other adventure. I'm wondering where we're at with the Hound a little bit, because presumably, you know, he's a fully committed member of the whatever they're called now, Brothers Without Banners. Is that what that group is?
Maybe we'll get ourselves another Cersei MAGA speech.
Yeah. Well, and look.
Is it MAWA? Make Westeros? That would be MUGA. MUGA? Make Westeros great again?
Yeah, that doesn't work great.
No.
But if we don't get that, we'll get Euron coming back, presumably, right? To I don't know. Are Yara and Theon the gift? That doesn't seem that gifty.
I was going to say, I mean, I think they are, but I feel like maybe he oversold it with the priceless gift thing.
Yeah, I think he did too. I think she's going to be like, this, a priceless gift? Not so much, mister. Maybe not with those words, but you catch my drift.
Yeah. I mean, I'm excited for how Varys and Littlefinger are potentially going to undermine things. And fantastic performance once again from Lady Elena, who, yep. You know.
That's the other thing. Exposition often involves really good talking scenes with characters I love, like Varys and Littlefinger and Lady Elena. And that doesn't bother me like it seems to bother some people.
I don't think the presence of exposition bothers people. I think when you have an episode full of exposition, that's when people get, you know, you want some other things.
I just don't entirely understand why exposition is a dirty word, especially when we're talking about a show that never fails to deliver some level of action and excitement.
Yeah.
Like, it literally never fails to deliver some level.
It can be rote. And look, I think we're now at the point where we're holding this show to a very high standard.
That's what it is. Yeah. That's my point. Is it's all of a sudden it's, you know, because you weren't All the Bastards, because you weren't Hard Home, because you weren't episodes we know the name of because of how incredible they were. Well, then we have to complain.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I'm not complaining.
I know you're not.
People do.
I understand you're, you know, making small points about things that weren't perfect, which is fine. I'm just saying I do think there's this cultural attitude where, like, once you raise the bar, you're not allowed to, you know, once you bench press 285 once, you're not allowed to push 250 10 times anymore.
Oh, man. I got to work on my bench. While we're here and talking about GOT expectations,
I think that's more a reflection of the fact that I've never really bench pressed anything in my life than of anyone's prowess on a
280 is a lot, man. That's a lot.
Well, Game of Thrones is very good. I meant to say something that was a lot. Okay. So maybe I was right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you succeeded. Anyway, while we're talking about expectations and Game of Thrones, I'm going to bring up something that we sort of talked about during the week a little bit and did not mention in our pre-show meeting at all. Confederate.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Did you?
Well, especially that was one of the reasons I thought of Handmaid's Tale as well.
For those of you who don't know what we're talking about, HBO has announced the next show from the creators of Game of Thrones, and it's going to be called Confederate and set in a world in which the South was successfully able to secede. They have had two civil wars since then and are headed for a third. And people have taken this premise, which was released in a press release, and kind of run with it, and they're not real happy. Your thoughts, Mr. Kolsky?
Okay. Here are my thoughts. There's no rule, or, well, obviously there's no law, but there's no unwritten rule necessarily that says this is a wrong thing to do in any way. That says it's, you know, racist to do this. That I don't think it's racist to do a show based on this idea. I think a show based on this idea is fraught with the danger of being racist on some level, but I trust these guys to do a good job. They're smart guys who've done a great job with the show, who have turned Game of Thrones in many ways into a feminist show. But I do wonder if you're Benioff and Weiss or HBO at large, and you have literally the entirety of history and your imagination to work with, why you choose this idea? What is it about that world that's exciting or interesting? Who wants to go to that world? Why do you want to go to that world? I just don't get it. Why can't you pick? You just did Game of Thrones. If you want to do something about slavery and you know, humanity, make up slaves in a fake world and don't make them all black people. I just don't understand why, of all the ideas humanly possible, which is literally no one has ever had more power in television to do whatever they wanted and more wherewithal to do so than these two guys at this exact moment. I just don't understand why you choose this.
Well, look, I think we can only assume that they've chosen to do a story in any kind of hypothetical world because they think that there is story potential to reveal something about our own. I am extremely wary of judging a piece of art that is literally not in existence yet. So,
that's the point I tried to make before I complained about it for 5 minutes.
I'm not saying that you were necessarily doing that. You're willing to give these guys some rope. And so am I. And I'm extremely heartened by the presence of the other two executive producers. And I'm forgetting their names. I believe one of them is like Nichelle. And the other two producers are a black executive producing couple. They're husband and wife. They've done a number of good shows. They're equal partners in this. You know what I mean? I'm not worried about this show being racially insensitive. If I'm worried about anything, it's that it seems to have a premise that's pretty similar to The Man in the High Castle, which imagines the world different. If the Nazis had won. But
yeah, and not that different philosophically from The Handmaid's Tale.
Sure, but like nobody's got a lock on dystopian future worlds. You know,
it's actually Malcolm Spellman is the guy, and
is it Nichelle Spellman? Did I get that right?
Nichelle Tramble Spellman. And Malcolm Spellman is not only a producer, he's also a big music guy as well, and I think a Bay Area guy.
Was he involved in Empire? Am I getting that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So look anyway. Yeah,
he wrote and produced on Empire, I believe.
So, I trust these guys. I trust the show will be good. And I would just say, bottom line, like, are you going to watch the show when it comes on?
Yeah, no. Right. Again, like, I don't think there's any reason to assume it wouldn't be good. You know, I think it will be good. And I expect I'll watch it. And look, I expect they will deftly avoid. I don't expect it to be a racist show. I'm trying to make sure I say
I get that.
That
sense.
I don't.
Yeah.
It's just I just.
You could just spend your time somewhere else. You just
yeah.
you would just hope that, like, you get a chance to spend your time somewhere else. I feel like
exactly. And if I mean, here's the thing. Like, I see the preview for the new James Franco HBO show, the new David Chase show.
Yes.
And I feel like now there's a dirty world with a lot of problematic things that looks fun to spend some time in.
Yeah, I get that. Here's my counterpoint to that. Is like, I mean, The Wire is absolutely, if not my favorite, and it may be my favorite. It's definitely one of my top five shows of all time.
It's the best show of all time.
And if you would have told me, you know, I just finished The Wire, and you told me, all right, David Simon's got two projects coming up. The first is going to be a study of New Orleans through the lens of jazz and their post-Katrina recovery. And the second one is going to be about a zoning district fight in Providence, Rhode Island in the mid-70s. I would say, all right, these are not worlds I would choose to spend my time in, you know? And one of those turned out to be really successful and one of them didn't, you know, in terms of, at least, you know, in my mind, artistically successful. But they're both interesting, and I feel like, you know what, I don't get to pick. And I don't really want to live in a world where I get to pick the world that we spend these times in. I'm going to let the geniuses work, you know what I mean? And we'll see how it comes out. Hopefully I'll like it. I won't always, but that's okay too. It'd probably be boring if we liked everything, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Fine. Agreed. That said, I can't help feeling that way. That, like, sure, that's true, and that's why I'll watch it, and that's why I'm saying it's probably going to be good. I don't think it'll be racist. I don't think that's even that reasonable of a fear to have, given the makeup of the production team. As you said, a well-known couple of African-American people who have produced TV shows I really enjoy in the past. Great. That's all fine. I still just don't know why there's not a different story. I don't know why this is number one on the list of all, again, infinite stories to tell. But again, but maybe when I watch it, I'll say, oh, this is incredible. This is why it was number one. I understand that, but I can't help feeling like you could have chosen anything.
Did you read the interview that Benioff and Weiss did about it?
The Vulture interview?
I think it was Vulture. Yeah, TV Mojo, I believe, is the Twitter handle of the guy that did the interview. I actually did read that.
I haven't read it all yet. It's one of the open tabs on one of my computers.
You should check it out. I think they talk a little bit about the process. All right. Should we switch to a different genius in a different world?
Well, I'm fascinated to know what you mean.
I mean, Christopher Nolan. And his new film, Dunkirk.
Okay. A different genius, he says. Interesting. Okay.
Do you not feel like Christopher Nolan is a genius?
I guess I've never thought about it. He probably is.
For me, if my favorite director is not David Fincher, it's Christopher Nolan.
Okay. I'm a little more of an oddball guy. I like a Tarantino. I love Woody Allen.
Yeah, I do really like Tarantino. I think how I feel about Woody Allen is on the record.
Yeah, and it's understandable.
I don't actually like his work, even, you know, forget the foibles. I find him to be really overrated. But that's another story for another day.
He's specific, but whatever. That's beside the point. Christopher Nolan's great. There's no question. Genius, sure. Why not? He's 46. Wow, I would have thought he was a lot older than that.
Yeah, me too. He's really been, you know, Memento came out a long time ago.
I believe 2000.
And
I am pulling up the filmography of Mr. Nolan as we speak.
He tends to take his time, I would say.
Yes. Yes. His Memento was 2000. He made two films before that, Doodlebug and Following, in 97 and 98. Doodlebug was a short film. I don't know what Following was.
Yeah, I don't even know if those were. I don't even know if those were in theaters.
And Following was in theaters.
Okay.
A 1998 British neo-noir crime drama. But, you know, inexpensive thing. But his debut feature. Anyway, Memento was 2000. So it's nearly 20 years of him being a major presence in movie making. And, you know, if you look down his films, first of all, with the exception of Insomnia, he wrote or took part in writing every feature he's directed. And there's not really a bad movie. So, yeah, I'll give you genius.
Yeah, I mean, I think he makes some great movies. He's clearly set the template for the new, for the current form of superhero movie.
At least for the DC side of it. And he is clever. I mean, the stuff he's made has been, even if you didn't love the way it worked out, you know, things like Inception and Interstellar and The Prestige are cleverly wrought, you know, well-crafted, twisty stories.
Yep, absolutely. So, as you can imagine, I was insanely excited to see Dunkirk, particularly once it started getting the kind of
raves.
Reviews that it's been getting, you know, words like masterpiece, Oscar words, lock.
Sentences like the best film Christopher Nolan has made.
Yes, have been flying around furiously. So I was like, I've got to see this movie.
Full disclosure, you more or less made me see this movie. I was not probably going to get around to it. Not that I was opposed to it, but there's a lot of stuff in the theaters I've been interested in. Dunkirk was pretty low on the list. Probably would not have seen it, but you and the universally fantastic reviews got me into an IMAX theater last night.
Oh, you saw it at IMAX. That's also part of the thing, apparently, is like, you know, Christopher Nolan wants people to see it in 70mm IMAX, whatever. I did not. I just saw it in a regular theater.
I can't imagine it makes that much of a difference.
I can't either. So this movie is visually stunning. One of the great scores that I think we've seen in a long time. It is an immersive experience. It is taut. It is striking, and I could not wait for it to be over.
Totally agree.
Like 30 minutes in, once I realized this was all the movie was going to be, I was like squirming in my seat. I was checking my watch. I have no desire to ever see it again. And I found it to be somewhat mystifying that people are raving about it like they are.
I heard someone compare this movie to There Will Be Blood. And the one place that feels accurate to me is the score.
Absolutely.
Because I thought Hans Zimmer did an unbelievable job. Because virtually any tension or excitement or any emotions whatsoever at all about this film were created solely by the score.
100%.
There is no character development. There is no story. There is nothing. It is the absolute worst version of the thing I thought might happen, which is why I didn't want to see it in the first place. Because I don't have time or interest for these storylines. And as
what storylines?
Well, that's what I'm saying. These lack of storylines. I don't have time or interest for these movies that... Like, I didn't see Pearl Harbor. I certainly have no need to revisit Armageddon or any of these boring pastiche storylines of war. Frankly, if I'm going to spend an hour and 40 minutes essentially learning about the Battle of Dunkirk in World War II, I would just as soon have it be with grainy news footage and actual reporting as the beautiful, right. You know, Kenneth Branagh studded visual thing that this was. And there's no doubt.
I barely learned anything about the Battle of Dunkirk, by the way. An hour and 47 minutes in. I learned it sucked. And some civilians joined in. You know,
had you ever heard of Dunkirk before this?
No, not really. You're right. I learned it existed.
It's a major event that I know a little bit about after knowing nothing about it. But again, I would have rather watched grainy news footage and heard actual facts being reported in a you know, hour and a half documentary if I was going to learn about Dunkirk. And again, Christopher Nolan is an artist, and visually, it's incredible.
And a great scriptwriter. Like, write a script, dude. Write a script with some dialogue and a story.
That's the thing. Midway through this, I found myself thinking, did this movie even have a script? And if so, it couldn't have been more than 20 pages long.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this. There's literally not one line in this movie that does anything other than set up the next war sequence.
Yeah, kind of. It's like he designed the movie for Tom Hardy. You know what I mean? Like, I'm gonna have a movie. Tom Hardy's gonna be in again. He's barely gonna say anything, and this will work. This is what we'll do to make that movie.
I was listening to some people rave about this, and someone said, jokingly, "Yeah, they really set it up for a sequel with Tom Hardy at the end." And I thought to myself, I would so much rather see the Christopher Nolan film that is the story of Tom Hardy's dramatic escape from custody than I would watch Dunkirk.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And I just, Amy, look, I'm really glad to hear you say this, because I feel like we've been consistent on the show about how much character and story matters.
Yes.
And this movie feels like an experiment in, like, what if I take everything else and turn it up to 11 and just completely leave that part out? And
I think to me, us, it's failure. That's the most important part.
Yeah. Like,
and it baffles me that, well, maybe baffle is the wrong word, but it disappoints me that other people in general and other people whose artistic opinions I respect so easily did away with what I feel is the most important. It's called storytelling for a reason.
Yeah.
You know? And if you don't tell any story, what are we doing here? It's a picture show. It's a slideshow.
Yep.
A beautiful slideshow.
I felt like it was an amusement park ride. That's what it seemed like to me. Like, you know, like you're at Epcot back in the day, and it's like Captain EO. The theater, like, could have rocked. You know what I mean?
Especially because there's so much first person shots, which actually, again, as beautiful as they were, I didn't love. Because when you're getting the first person shot of a pilot in a dogfight in 1946 or whatever it is, you can't see anything.
Yep.
You have no idea what's going on.
You're all over the place. Stuff might, like, you know, I try to explain to people, you know, it's like this movie, like, if you really like the first 10 minutes of whatever it is of Saving Private Ryan and just wanted to see that for a whole movie, it's kind of that. Or
that's the difference to me between Saving Private Ryan, which I saw and is great and I really enjoyed, and to choose another Spielberg film, War Horse, which I didn't see because it's a horse. And I knew I wasn't going to get a satisfying story or characters.
Yeah.
And this is War Horse. This is Christopher Nolan's War Horse.
Here it's like here are some people. Some of them will live. Some of them will die. The ones that will die at any moment. That's the whole movie. Like, that's it. That's it. That's the whole movie. Like, you don't, it's not like you understand what any of these people's real role in the battle was. They're just there, and they're just trying to live. And I grant you that may be what the literal experience of being in that battle was like. But, like, that's not illuminating to take me to that and to go back to the central theme of this particular podcast we seem to be on. It's not a world that is fun to spend time in.
It's not film worthy. It's, again, it's slideshow worthy. It's documentary worthy. But you could have chosen a story in this, within this day or week or hour that would have been film worthy, but you didn't. And so what we're left with is just, I think you describing it as an amusement park experience is perfect. If this was, you know, a 3-story line, 20 to 25 minute amusement park experience where you could either be Tom Hardy in the air, you know,
or Harry Styles
one of
the
guys
ground.
On the ship, or the guy on the beach, and you got to fight through the thing and live the experience, then it would make sense.
Yep.
Oh, by the way, as a film, it doesn't make sense to me.
The acting performances are all very good. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's
There's nothing wrong with them, but there's nothing to them.
Yeah, it's well, it's
we don't know any of those people. We don't get to know. There's not even an attempt to tell us anything about these people. It's almost as if the point was to not tell us anything about those people.
It's well crafted old timey violence porn. All right.
Yeah, and again, I can't say enough good things about the score, because truly any emotion is 100% the music.
Yeah.
There's nothing from the plot.
But
whatsoever.
That occurred to me like 20 minutes in, that it was like, oh, well, the score is doing all the heavy lifting. I feel is because the music's ratcheting up and telling me this is the emotion I need to feel at this moment. And like, that's lazy. Sorry. Like, you know, the score is beautiful, but it's lazy. All right. I feel like we've hacked that enough. I have to say, I was definitely expecting to fight with you about this one because I seem to be the only person that didn't love it. But I'm glad that you came out on my side.
I honestly don't. It's one of the most – this happens to me every so often where I don't understand what happened to the critic culture.
Yeah. Like, you look around and you're like –
this is one of them.
I'm like, am I standing on hot take corner here? You know what I mean? Like – but no, to me, this is very real, and I'm glad to hear that you had that same experience. So,
well, yeah, and I'm emboldened by the fact that like I'm an easy hook. So if I'm sitting in the theater in the middle of a war film, going, "Why do I care?" Like, I feel like you've really failed dramatically.
Yeah,
because I get hooked into virtually every dumb superhero movie that comes out, but nothing from Dunkirk.
See, now,
in other words, I don't need much in the way of a story. You know what I mean? I just want you to try. Give me something to sink my teeth into, and this didn't even attempt it.
Yeah, and I'm Christopher Nolan guy. I should have known because I saw the trailer for this, and I was like, this looks stupid. And then it came on at the end. It's like, directed by Christopher Nolan. I'm like, oh, guess I'm going. And I should have trusted my initial instincts. So what are you going to do?
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to the Defiant ones. Wowie. Because, you know, it's funny. We talked about a war movie. To me, I feel like my take on the Defiant ones, which is the documentary that's been running on HBO about the life of Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine.
Yeah.
Is actually a war line, and it's that history is written by the victors. You know? These guys are obviously some of the most accomplished people in entertainment in our times. You know, this 4-part documentary certainly reveals the scope of their impact on the music and the business world. But it's also clearly written with their participation in mind, and is able to soft focus and play the real foibles that some of these people have had in their lives, real struggles, real issues, as, you know, teachable moments. You know, I mean.
Well, okay. Can I stop you for a sec?
Okay.
So obviously we're talking about the Dre, you know, one of the things you're talking about is Dre's assault. I don't know if it's an assault conviction, but
yeah, definitely. That's a thing.
What other sorts of things are you thinking about when you say this?
Like detox, the whole detox era, or, you know, the kind of shelving of detox, I think is.
What do you feel like they shied away from?
It's not that they shied away from it. I feel like it was just sort of put in the softest possible terms. I think
terms would you put detox in?
All of Jimmy's divorce, you know what I mean, all of Jimmy's divorces, all of Jimmy's screwing people over in business. You know what I mean? Like, you know, the kind of like, I may have wrecked Tom Petty's album. Like, it's just kind of like, oh, here's a funny story about how, you know what I mean? Like, stuff like that. It's just, I'm not saying
but
any
you've
of
got
this
Tom
room.
Petty there, who seems to be his dear friend, yeah. And I don't think he tried to wreck yeah. Tom Petty's album. So, like, what?
I'm not saying that
you have them address that. I hear what you're saying, but at the same time, I actually think while that stuff's not, it's not a documentary about the things they've done wrong, obviously. They, I think, mention and at least address the things they've done wrong more than they ever have before.
Yes. Well, look, Dre has never really addressed the Dee Barnes thing publicly. So the fact that he's talking about it, I guess is a thing.
Look,
I left out the Ferrari thing and the whatever and the, you know what I mean?
That's fine. And here's can you forgive these guys for doing these things? I don't know. That's up to every individual person. But
I mean, Dre went to prison.
That's right. But I think Dre responded. Again, whether it satisfies anyone is up to every individual person.
You know, the Tupac murders in there. You know what I mean?
And I think they spoke as I viewed it. These guys spoke as honestly and directly as they could about these things. And I think they, again, addressed them more than they've generally been addressed in the past. And what else can Dre say?
But
what he said.
Let me put it this way now. We've now seen Straight Outta Compton, which we talked about in the show and I loved. Like, and
that left out Barnes altogether.
Right. And we've now seen this, and I just feel like what we know of the narrative of the Dr. Dre story, of the lens of NWA, of Eazy-E. I mean, think about how many times we've now had the recounting of the Dr. Dre's visit to Eazy-E's deathbed, right? The only version of that story that we know and that we will ever know is the Dr. Dre version of that, right? That is now the truth on the record. It's on the record in these two places that are public, and I think it's
life,
interesting.
What do you think was what do you doubt that? You doubt the veracity of the Eazy-E storyline that he saw him once before he died?
I don't know if doubt is the right word. I just find it seems a little bit convenient that it's like, well, you know, we hated each other for years, and then, you know, I had this point visit to the deathbed, and now it's like, and look, maybe that's the way it happened. I don't know. I'm not. It's not even that I'm necessarily doubting it. It's just that I feel hyper aware that I know now all of these, you know, points in this man's life, and this thing happened, and this thing happened, and this thing happened, and there are other people involved, and there were other people that were hurt. But the only version I know is the version that this guy is telling me. And
well, except that Dee Barnes is in this, Tom Petty is in this, Jimmy Iovine's ex-wife is in this, and yeah, that's always going to be the case to some degree. But I do feel that for a documentary produced, if not by, certainly around the two guys it focuses on, they certainly gave the old college try as far as attempting to
I'll give you another example.
The story fairly.
I'll give you another example of a thing that's not even really discussed in this. Like, Jimmy Iovine systematically killed rock and Interscope Records. You know, in the mid-2000s. You know what I mean? Like, just said, we're going to drop every rock band they had. And currently, the Interscope roster, I think, has four or five rock bands, and one of them's like U2. They recently started signing a few, but like, he's, and people in the business know that Jimmy Iovine said, like, on the record, like, we're getting rid of rock, you know? Including that in the story of the guy's history of the music business to me, I'm feeling like that probably got left out of the documentary because that undercuts his, like, Springsteen, Patti Smith, no doubt, U2 legacy. And, you know, he wants to be seen as a visionary, right? So.
Okay, fair enough. But I do think that, yeah, what do I know? But it seems like that was his vision was we're going to hip hop and included for whatever, you know, whatever. I'm not defending a guy.
Yeah, look, I'm not, you know, and I'm not killing this documentary. I enjoyed it. I mean, I thought four, you know, hour plus episodes was maybe a little much. It could have been two or three. But
yeah.
I think for the most part, it is enjoyable. I, you know, obviously, I know these people are titans. I was not quite aware the extent of the amount of music that they had touched. No. That was really interesting.
The best part.
Yeah. Like there's some really great footage. People say some interesting things. I enjoyed this documentary. Like I kind of led with just sort of my observation about it. And it's it is sort of a criticism, but it's not a like. I don't think it undermines the work in general, but I do think that it's something that needs to be noted. You know, like hey, it's pretty clear you have this documentary made by the subject, and like many subject made documentaries, like you feel like it's going to be very generous to the people involved. Now it's not on the level of, you know, like say like the Kobe Bryant documentary, you know what I mean? But like, or you know, or some of the stuff that got done by, you know, it gets done about any athlete really. But yeah. I felt like it was honest, but I wouldn't call it uncompromising.
Fine. I would agree with that, but it was honest. And I think again, I just view it from the other end. Was it, we will never know what, if anything, Dr. Dre whispered in the ear of the now deceased Eazy-E in the final moments of his life. We will never know more about the Dee Barnes incident than we just learned in this documentary.
I mean,
Isn't
everything you know about the NWA split essentially like through the narrative lens of Dre and Cube?
Yeah, but I like that's not one narrative lens. That's two very different narrative lenses that seem to agree about the basic facts. And both of them, whether it's by choice or because it's what really happened, have chosen to tell the story as we both were trying we were both in the process of reconciling with our estranged other group member. And
I'm not necessarily talking about like the Eazy-E, like Eazy-E dying and reconciling. I'm talking about like the split with Jerry Heller and
but
the band and all of that stuff.
But Ice Cube and Dre were not friends when it happened, but they both seem to agree about the basic process and facts.
Right.
And so do Ren and Yella.
And Ren and Yella are around. I just feel like
I understand, but Eazy-E's dead. What are you gonna do? You can't get that back. And I think this, by virtue of its basic honesty, if not complete, at least basic honesty, I think we get more here than we ever have before, and than we're ever likely to get again. And I choose to look at that as like a small victory rather than lament the parts we still will never really know about.
Yeah, you're right. Look, and this documentary is worth seeing. Like, I'm not.
I think it's definitely.
I'm not knocking it. It's an interesting watch.
Especially if you're a fan of 90s hip hop.
Yeah. Or rock, for that matter.
It's fascinating because the Jimmy Iovine stuff, there's so much I did not know about him as a sort of man on the scene.
Yeah. I got to tell you, the early shots of U2. Like oh young, hungry U2.
Climbing up the stage.
You're like, man, those guys were a force, you know?
They were. And I also have to say, I think you're probably in the same boat as me, age-wise. I'm not sure I fully appreciated young Stevie Nicks before watching this documentary.
Oh, I'm a Fleetwood Mac fan. I had an old girlfriend who was very into Fleetwood Mac, so I kind of jumped into that. One of the prouder things that I've done is I have a cover of I have a copy of the Buckingham Nicks solo album, in which they are both young and nude on the cover. Signed by both of them. That made me very happy.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
She was it.
Yeah, she was. She really was.
So yeah, but
cocaine's a hell of a drug, people.
Yeah, cocaine's a hell of a drug. Jimmy Iovine is a pretty incredible guy, and I think, you know, look, we've had the same arguments in many ways about the Steve Jobs story, which has been told so many times over the last few years, right? Is like, yeah, he's a visionary, but what about all this stuff where he cut people's legs off business-wise and you know, did some questionable things in his personal life? Like, he's not a saint. But I do think that, but it doesn't mean that every story that doesn't nail these people to the wall is a failure.
Yeah, look, I'm not looking for them to necessarily pay their penance. I don't know. I just felt like maybe there was more here. You know, it's 4 hours, and I shouldn't feel like maybe there's more to the story when we're done.
That's fair. I will say again, though, that like everyone has to decide whether they can forgive a guy that drunkenly threw a woman into a wall.
Right. You know,
but I do think if you're talking about what can that person, after making that horrible mistake, if that's in fact what it was, what can that person do contrition-wise? I do think Dr. Dre has been the best version of that.
I don't have a problem with Dr. Dre. I don't have a problem. I'm not saying Dr. Dre has made mistakes and he needs to pay. And I, look,
no,
and
I, well, that's what I'm saying. I think he has paid.
Yeah.
He's made mistakes and he has paid.
Yeah, and been paid a lot.
Well, he's been paid for his successes,
yes.
which are numerous and you know, deserve attention.
Yeah, for sure.
Also, one takeaway that
Eminem's great, by the way.
That's it.
Yeah,
that was great. My surprising takeaway. the most surprising takeaway from the Jimmy Iovine Dr. Dre documentary is that I hate being the white guy that says this. The best rapper in that movie, in that 4 hours, is a white man named Marshall Mathers.
Well,
Snoop,
I mean,
Dre,
Tupac and Big are in the movie.
Tupac, Biggie, these guys are all incredible for all the reasons we know. I think if I had to pick favorites, I still put Biggie ahead of Eminem. But if we're just talking about the, because you forget that.
What about Puffy?
Guys,
sorry.
What's that?
I said, what about Puffy? Sorry.
Yeah. if you want your producer out the videos.
By the way, like, I mean, I know that was another thing. Actually, you know what? I felt like they probably did the Source stuff fairly. But that was another thing. Like, yeah, they probably did touch off maybe a violent war, but man. Great shots. What a great shot that was.
Holy moly.
You want to get your producer out of the video.
Yeah. And like, he was right. He's an asshole, but yeah. He was right.
That's why it hurt so much, because there was some truth in it. If you don't want your producer dancing
so
in your videos, so
he's
good.
Not over it at all.
Yeah. Oh, no. He's still mad. So great.
And in his defense, Suge Knight is one of the great famous dirtbags of all time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
There's a lot to like here, and if you're a fan of the music especially, the stories are great.
Yeah. Look, every man has to decide if they can make peace with Dr. Dre getting drunk and putting someone in a wall. But very few men have to decide if they can make peace playing next to LeBron James.
Yeah.
And apparently not everyone can do that. I don't know if it's a plot by Adam Silver, but like we were at a point, I mean, I can remember on this podcast talking to you about the NBA season and how it feels like it never ends.
Yep.
We are now at the point where it literally never ends, and I'm perfectly okay with it. I don't know how that's happened. But the NBA's year-round phenomenon continues, and now for the next couple of weeks we will be preoccupied with where Kyrie Irving is playing basketball next year.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the best part about this is if he doesn't get traded and he's in Cleveland, well, the drama is going to be just delightful. But to trade him, it would have to be such a monstrous blockbuster that drama will be phenomenal. So putting aside where you started this conversation, which is with the fact that what Kyrie is doing is unthinkable and I think massively moronic.
Well, look, I'll give Winhurst credit. Let's say that's like that's hard. Oh, but I'm gonna give Winhurst credit because I think that he framed this issue well in a way that at least sort of made me understand Kyrie's position.
Oh, I understand. Yeah. He's just wrong.
Well, yeah, let me look. First of all, it's his life. He can't, like, he's not allowed, he can't be wrong. You know what I mean? Like, a man can, you know, decide what his destiny and his professional life is going to be.
Yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
What but, role but he wants to take
he can
on.
Be wrong.
No, he can't. He's doing what's right for him and for his life and for his family.
So by that rationale, anything anyone does is what's right for them.
Mostly,
I disagree with that.
Like,
no, I
this
disagree.
Is why,
with that.
This
people
is why.
Do what's wrong. Look at the election. People do what's wrong for them all the time.
Well, look, no, I'm not saying. I mean, yeah, look, I'm not saying. Here's the thing: is I think when you're talking about what's right and wrong for someone, doesn't that in some way like depend on their values? And I go back to the conversation, and I think feel like we've had this conversation of the, you know, so-and-so blank, oh, they should retire. You know, they should hang it up. They're not any good anymore. Well, like,
that's different. That's
to me,
different.
It's a man's prerogative to, you know, as long as someone's willing to offer a contract,
hold on,
the same
hold
he's
on,
done.
Hold on. These are different things. It's his prerogative. He has every right to use the leverage he has created by being great to force whatever situation he may think he wants. What I'm saying is he may think he wants out of Cleveland right now. He's wrong. He shouldn't be doing this. Suck it up. Play a season, one more season, with the greatest player of all time. If he leaves, you've got Cleveland to yourself, or you've got an easy pitch to the Cavs to say, you guys are rebuilding. Rebuild without
but
me.
You're leaving. I was gonna say you're leaving out something in that I don't think he likes the Cleveland organization. I think he's had
That's
problems
fine.
With the Cleveland organization
That's
for
fine.
Years.
Then you demand a trade after the season when Cleveland is tearing things down anyway, when you'll have more options of where to be sent. If he had made this trade demand 2 months ago. If he had gone in the day after the finals and said this, if he had gone in the minute David Griffin wasn't retained and said this.
I think he did, actually.
No.
At least from the way the
No,
way
the, because he didn't do it until after the draft, until after the beginning of free agency.
Oh, right, you're right. Because they were trying to trade him during the draft, and I think for him was a final straw. So
that's
it was like, all right,
again,
trade me.
Again, I understand. I think it's a bad decision.
Let me ask you, to me, I guess maybe the closest comparable, and I'm not comparing these guys in terms of like their all-time legacies. It's not obviously unequal, but to me, the most similar situation wouldn't it be Kobe and Shaq, and Kobe saying, Kobe forcing the dissolution of that partnership. Now, I thought that was the wrong thing to do in terms of Kobe's life and career and. Like, win championships with Shaq. You can do that. Why are you deliberately sabotaging this team? And they did get worse immediately. But I also feel like it's not my life. Like, I'm just a guy on the outside, you know? I would rather you played with Shaq, but it's not up to me.
But I think it's important to note, we don't know everything behind the scenes, but where there's smoke, there's fire, and we knew a lot about the problems that were going on with that Lakers team, and it wasn't just Kobe and Shaq, it was Karl Malone, it was Gary Payton, there was
I think the problems in this Cleveland team are a lot deeper than just LeBron James and Kyrie Irving. A lot deeper. And I think we've seen a lot of evidence of that over a long period of time.
The problems with this team are largely in the front office, specifically the ownership. But because LeBron is LeBron, they're competing for titles.
Yep.
And Kyrie Irving is not being short shrifted. He got more shots than LeBron James last year. He had 20 games or whatever where it was his team basically during the regular season. In the finals, he was universally lauded for his incredible scoring performances. It doesn't get better this year than Cleveland.
Do you think Kyrie Irving is one of the 10 best players in the NBA?
10's tough, but he's in that range.
Do you think if I took it to 12?
I'd have to count, but okay. Yeah, ish. Maybe.
I mean,
15.
I think he's like 7 or 8, personally.
I don't think he's 7 or 8, but I think he's between 10 and 15.
But like, regardless, he's somewhere in that range.
He plays no defense, but he's
I agree,
one of
and you know that I hate that part. But like,
but he may be the best one-on-one scorer in the league, yeah. And what he can do,
and he's certainly the best ball handler in the league.
Top three. And what he can do around the basket.
What do you mean top? Like, I mean, look, Steph Curry is probably my favorite player, an amazing ball handler, but Kyrie Irving's better dribbling the ball than Steph is.
I don't know about that. They're right there neck and neck, and don't sleep on Jamal Crawford.
I'm certainly sleeping on Jamal Crawford. One amazing crossover does not make one better than Kyrie Irving with the dribbling ball.
No. Jay Smooth can handle.
So, look, I guess my point is that Kyrie Irving is I'd say, let's say without question, one of the top 15 guys in the league. Okay. Fair?
Yes.
All right. He's made one All-NBA team. And he did not make an All-NBA team this year. And I'm not trying to justify this. I'm not saying that this is what I would have done if I were Kyrie Irving, but I can understand why Kyrie Irving maybe feels like he's not recognized as much as maybe he could be because he's playing with the third greatest player of all time, and he's always going to be in that guy's shadow, and he's won a championship, and now he, wants to see what life could be like. Can he win more as the guy? Like, again, not the route I would have taken, but that's an understandable position to me.
Let me ask you something, okay? This Cleveland Cavaliers team with LeBron James and Kyrie Irving won 50 games.
Yes. Which is about 12 less than you would expect, right?
About.
Yeah.
Do you believe Kyrie Irving had a better season than James Harden or Russell Westbrook?
I don't.
Do you believe he had a better season than Steph Curry or Isaiah Thomas in Boston?
Definitely not Steph. Probably not Isaiah.
Okay. So he's not even in the argument for the first or second team.
Okay.
Third team
this year,
is where,
by the way,
you
this year.
Think, what's that?
I'm talking about, yes, this season he was not.
That's right, this season.
Okay.
Where it gets tricky is John Wall and DeMar DeRozan. That being said,
if I'm Kyrie Irving, I take 1,000% think I'm a better basketball player than DeMar DeRozan. And I had a better year.
I think he's a better basketball player than DeMar DeRozan. I think he's a better basketball player than Isaiah Thomas. The question is, did he have a better season? I would argue he did not have a better season than John Wall, who averaged almost 11 assists a game, shot almost as well from the field as Kyrie, and played terrific defense for much of the year as well.
That's kind of my point, is I think that Kyrie views this, not that, John Wall, didn't have a better year than me, but that John Wall has the opportunity as the guy with the ball in his hands all the time to do the things that he did that got him on the All-NBA team. Whereas if I'm playing with LeBron James, the offense is always going to run through him. There's no opportunity for me to get to be a guy who has 10, 11 assists a game.
I'm not sure that's fair when he shot the ball more than LeBron
but
this year.
Shooting the ball is not possessing the ball. You know what I mean? And I don't know. Look, I think that's the way he views it. I don't think it's crazy unreasonable. And the other thing that I would add, and frankly, I'm stealing this from Winhurst as well, is that, when you look at the teams, New York Knicks accepted, which I assume is just him about, just about him.
He's a New York guy, yeah.
The teams that he requested a trade to either have a strong coach, a strong organization behind them, or both, right? Miami, San Antonio, super stable organizations, respected head coaches. Minnesota, maybe not super stable organization, but very respected head coach who is really kind of in charge of the organization now as well. So, you know, I think there's also some things that maybe he was looking for outside of Cleveland that he doesn't have.
That's right. But if he wanted to actually get to any of those places, he's got a much better chance of doing it next year. Because right now, he's talking about a Minnesota team that just signed a point guard. They now can't trade until the middle of the season in Jeff Teague. And the San Antonio Spurs are tied up with contracts they can't get out of and have no assets whatsoever to trade for Kyrie Irving. And Miami is a place where Dion Waiters is like a guy he had shipped out of town, yeah, basically, from Cleveland, who's one of the leaders of that team. And again, no real assets to put into a Kyrie Irving trade. You know, I hear you. I understand all the things he's doing. Again, I understand his points. I think many of them are valid. He's just doing it wrong. Because having this public now puts you in a really bad situation for everyone.
Yeah, maybe. But I don't know that he necessarily intended for it to go public.
He should know better.
But there are,
he should know better. I don't care if LeBron leaked it or not. I heard Brian Windhorst point this out. A story this big, you don't have one.
LeBron. I wasn't trying to make a Stephen A. Smith type assertion.
No. I know. I'm making the point about Kyrie. It doesn't matter who leaked it. Everything comes out. So thinking right, you can go to the Cavs
but
management.
He's thinking it's going to come out after the trade and not, you know what I mean? Like, and not then, you know, yes, this has changed, probably changed the calculus of it somewhat.
You should know better.
But I do think that, you know, look, I think if you're Miami or San Antonio or Minnesota, that, you know, it's the NBA. People want assets. There are, you know, three-way, four-way trades and things that you can make. Bill Simmons posted a fake trade that sent Kyrie to Minnesota that I thought was excellent. I really feel like Minnesota.
You think Kyrie and Jeff Teague on the same team is excellent in any circumstance?
Look, I think Kyrie and Jeff Teague are on the same team until December. You know what I mean? Like,
well,
that's,
I know
that is what it is.
You're not getting anything for Jeff Teague then.
Sure, you
like,
are.
This is
maybe not getting full value, but you get something.
An overpaid point guard in a league of point guard depth where isn't going to get his best opportunity.
Not everybody's got a point guard, man. Like, not everybody's got one. There are a lot of good ones, but not everybody's got one. And you can do okay. I mean, look, Jeff Teague found a deal, right? And you know what I mean? So
he found a desperate Minnesota team that traded
away. They weren't that desperate. There were other guys in the market. They could have taken George Hill. They could have taken Derrick Rose. They took Jeff Teague. You know what I mean? And there are probably other guys on top of that.
I'm not sure they could have taken George Hill.
George Hill was a free agent when they signed Jeff Teague as a free agent.
Yeah, but
and expressed interest.
Okay. All right.
I mean, he was definitely a guy they were targeting.
Yeah, fine. This is not me crushing Jeff Teague, who's a perfectly decent player. I think he adds to the Timberwolves. I think moving him in December in the first year of a pretty large contract is going to be tough. I don't think it's impossible. I don't think Kyrie is wrong to want a different situation. That's his prerogative. I think this is the wrong way to go about getting into the situation you want.
I mean,
even if you get that trade to Minnesota, it was going to be easier in a year.
Maybe. But we're talking about this from Minnesota's angle for a second, because I live here and probably going to have season tickets next year. And so I give a damn. But don't you think, I mean, I feel like we've talked about this any number of times, that what almost every non-contending team is trying to do is amass three of the 20 best players in the league, because that's what you kind of have to do now to compete with Golden State and what we thought was Cleveland.
Do you think Cleveland had three of the best 20 players in the league?
I think they thought they did. But I think that's what everyone's trying to do.
No. Well, yes, but
certainly
again,
what Houston's trying
my
to
point.
Do.
They didn't have, and yet they were easily the second best team in basketball last year.
But my point is that's the goal. And here is Minnesota with now an opportunity to acquire three of the top 15 players in the league. Three of the top 15.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's another thing about Kyrie. If you go to Minnesota, you probably go from not from number two to number one, but to number three in terms of the pecking order.
He's still gonna have the ball is gonna run through him.
But is that gonna how are Jimmy Butler and Karl Anthony Towns gonna feel about that?
Well, look, the ball's never gonna run through Karl Anthony Towns. He's 7 foot tall.
So nobody needs a lot of touches. I think he'll be okay. He's gonna want touches.
You know, if
he's not going to want Kyrie dribbling for 15 seconds and then taking a crazy layup.
I don't know, man.
I love watching that. It's not what Jimmy Butler and Karl Anthony Towns are going to be about.
I think if you're Karl Anthony Towns, if you're Karl Anthony Towns, I don't think there's that much difference in terms of Kyrie and Jimmy Butler on your team as there is in Andrew Wiggins and Jimmy Butler on your team. Like those are guys who are gonna want shots and want the ball and are known to dribble 10, 15 seconds out of the shot clock and do their thing. Like that's what it's gonna be. So,
I think that is a misconception of Jimmy Butler based on the fact that he was the only guy who could dribble the ball and score for the last 2.5 years of his Bulls career.
It's not a knock on Jimmy Butler. I'm not knocking.
I understand what I'm saying.
These guys want shots.
Misconception.
You know.
I understand you're not dissing him. I'm saying I think you see a pretty different Jimmy Butler as part of a triumvirate than you did as a basic lone dog for the last few years. That's true about Wiggins. I think he will find himself with a loud, gruff, gravelly voice in his ear until he begins to move the ball a little bit more, or he will find himself on the bench more than he likes because Tom Thibodeau is going to make the ball move.
He had that for a whole season, I honestly did not see a ton of growth in his game last year, and that's why I really believe that the Wolves are a better team. And look, the Wiggins, Cat, Butler triumvirate is very exciting. We were all very excited when it came together, but the Kyrie Towns Butler triumvirate is better, and I'd be worth it for to ride out 6 months of extra Jeff Teague on my roster to make it happen.
Well, but then you have to worry about retaining Kyrie the year after that. So it would have been easier in a year. That's all I'm saying. That's it. I get why he wants out, but I don't get why he wouldn't hang around for a year, contribute to a championship, and then attempt at least, and then try to make this happen.
Because we don't see everything, and sometimes your life changes the timing for you. You know what I mean? Sometimes you just like, I can't go around with these people anymore. You know?
I get it. I know that feeling. I understand. I think it's the wrong way to go about it.
And like when you are when you're a multimillionaire with rings and the second most popular Nike shoe, then you know, you have some options, you know, and when you don't want to put up with stuff, you feel like you don't do it anymore.
That's fine. I have no problem with him exercising his power as it exists. That I'm good with that. That's what it look. You better believe Dan Gilbert has no loyalty to any of these guys. He has proven that more than anyone in the past. So I have no problem with Kyrie using what he's got to force what he wants. Right. I think he's wanting wrong.
Well, how do you feel about me exercising my power to leave this podcast?
I think there's an argument to be made. One of us should have done that several minutes ago.
That's quickly, fair. All right, let's do homework.
So you were supposed to listen to the rapper Cupcake last week.
I didn't
fail.
Yeah, I failed.
So we're going to add to that the Nine Inch Nails EP that is newly out. So that's a couple of things to listen to.
And I've already done that, so I'm like at least ahead of the game, sort of.
So at least we know one of the two things you will have listened to by next week. In addition to Cupcake the Rapper, which you can just find her on Spotify or YouTube and check out a few things, Nine Inch Nails EP and a couple of films, Girls Trip and Atomic Blonde. And so Atomic Blonde is the Charlize Theron kills everybody movie that looks awesome to me and has gotten good response to the extent that I've seen any so far. Girls Trip is a movie starring Tiffany Haddish, who is, first of all, a delightful actress and a hilarious comic person. She was one of, if not the female lead of Keanu, which was a comedy I really loved. and has been in a handful of things. She also, I just happen to know from hearing her on the Champs podcast, has one of the most upsetting, harrowing life stories you can ever hear. And it's a miracle that she's alive, much less the seemingly happy, successful individual that she is. And fun fact, the other day, I went with a buddy to see the Planet of the Apes on a Friday, and we failed to calculate, so walked into the theater that was basically totally full and ended up trading in our tickets for a show an hour later, wandered around the mall for like 30 minutes and showed up to the new one 30 minutes early. And as we walked towards our new theater room, there was like roped off lines of no less than 100 or so people. And we were like, what the, is this really Planet of the Apes? Like a week after it came out, is still this popular? This is insane. And then based on the demographics of the line,
you were like, oh,
I realized it was not, it was not in fact a line for Planet of the Apes at all. I realized this at first because there were almost no men in the line. And also I quickly realized virtually no white people in the line. And this was like a just, you know, this is not at a predominantly one way or the other theater. This is just the like local mall theater. It was just literally 100, if not 200 black women lined up to see Girls Trip. And we also saw them on the way out, and it sure seemed like they had a good time. So I am very excited about this movie.
All right. Yeah. I mean, I've heard great things. That's why I put it on the list. You know, you never know with these things. You know, sometimes you get a really funny one. Sometimes they are, just, you know, oh, there's somebody ripped off Bridesmaids. But I hear this one's great, and, you know, and so I'm excited to check it out.
This is another movie where I see the cast, and I'm like, it's hard to imagine not at least having fun.
Yeah. Agreed. Queen Latifah, Regina Hall, Jada Pinkett Smith are your other leads.
Yeah. And Tiffany Haddish is just, she's just one of my favorites. And I would recommend, by the way, the Champs podcast with Moshe Kasher and Neil Brennan. It's been dead for a while, but they still exist. And there's some incredible interviews. Tiffany Haddish may be the best one.
All right. All right. So we got that. We got Atomic Blonde, which is Charlize Theron killing people. And
I'm so excited to watch Charlize Theron kill people. Yes.
Between this and Game of Thrones, it might be shaping up as the summer of the ladies.
Yeah. I'm all in on the summer of ladies committing justified murder.
All right. And on that note, I'm going to go back to the rest of my life, and we'll murder this podcast.
Get to work, man. Yeah. Jeez. Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.